From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan Congresswoman Debbie Dingell takes up the cause of student debt.
It's not only the tuition. It's the room and board. It's the fees that are built into courses. It's the cost of books.
Billionaire developer and super donor Stephen Ross on Detroit and the firing of U of M's athletic director.
What is really interesting about this whole thing, as you put it together over time, is you find out that a lot of the major players never knew each other.
Dan Gilbert's Rocket Fiber is the latest bid to bring lightning-fast internet to downtown Detroit businesses. But what does the future hold for neighborhoods?
They might talk about allocating and distributing tiers of high speed service, so it won't be gigabit speed.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. What is the ultimate goal of Rocket Fiber, the Dan Gilbert-backed business? To bridge the digital divide in Detroit by providing ultra-high-speed internet to downtown Detroit, midtown Detroit, and beyond. What might the future hold for neighborhoods? I'm Cynthia Canty. That story and more on today's Stateside. But first, struggling to repay student loans is something that unites a lot of us. Across the nation, something like 40 million people are trying to repay $1.3 trillion in student loan debt. Here in Michigan, 1.5 million people are trying to pay back more than $39 billion in debt. Earlier today, Michigan Congresswoman Debbie Dingell was on the campus of the University of Michigan, where she hosted a roundtable on college affordability. Congresswoman, thank you for being with us today.
Cindy, it's great being with you and being with everybody.
When I hear those figures, that is toe-curling when you're talking about $1.3 trillion in student loan debt. And it clearly means something to you because you're one of the sponsors of a bill in the House called the Bank on Students Emergency Loan Reinforcement Act. How would this bill help address this burden of student loan debt?
This would allow students to refinance their current student debt. So many of the young people out there, except so many of them aren't young anymore because they've been carrying this debt for a long time. You can refinance your home. You can refinance your auto loan, but you can't refinance your student loan right now. And this would allow an undergraduate student to refinance their current student loans and would average the average debt right now for an undergraduate student is about $30,000, and it would save them $4,000. You know, look at what the cost of medical school is these days. Look at what the cost of law school is. And medical students are graduating with an average debt of $200,000. It's staggering how much it costs. And for a student, it's not only the tuition. It's the room and board. It's the fees that are built into courses. It's the cost of books. And for graduate students, it's your living expenses. Many of them are married. They've got families. It's expensive.
As you say, this is one piece of a big puzzle. What more do you want to see to happen to address this overall problem of what it costs to get a college education in America?
Well, there are several different things the kids have given me the ideas about. One is teaching financial literacy in high school. Many of them get these loans and don't understand what the loans are or the grants are there to cover. And I've heard that from the kids themselves, and I hadn't really thought about it until I was doing the roundtables with the kids. So I think that that's something that's very important, trying to teach them all financial literacy in terms of
And understand economics.
And understanding economics.
And this is something I'm real interested in your answer, Congresswoman. In 22 states, people can lose their driver's licenses for not paying their student loans. Now, we'll note Michigan is not one of them. But student loan debt follows you to your grave. You can't get it forgiven even if you file for personal bankruptcy. I'm wondering, why do our laws come down so hard on people with student loan debt, and yet corporations and businesses have all kinds of means at their disposal to have tens, even hundreds of millions of dollars of their debt wiped off the books?
Well, I don't think that's right. And I think that I don't want to encourage people to not pay off their debt, their loans. I think that's a responsibility that all of us have. But as I said to you earlier, even in the refinancing, you can refinance your home or your auto, but not a student loan. And yet this is human capital we're talking about. This is young people right now that we're talking about. They're 25% of our population and 100% of our future. And students come in all forms. Most of them are young people, but we've got many people returning to the workforce, getting new skills.
There's so much talk of job retraining. And with the Bank on Students Emergency Loan Reinforcement Act, where does it stand right now in terms of support in the House?
Well, I'm hoping that we can get people to support it. Elizabeth Warren introduced it in the last Congress, and it didn't get through the Senate. I don't think it's a partisan issue. I'm hoping that we can get something like this through the House and the Senate. I'm going to work very hard to try to do that. I think people sent us to Washington to find solutions to problems. This is a problem that needs people to come together to help our young people on, and I'm hoping we're going to be able to get it through this Congress.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, thank you so much for being with us and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most devastating weather events in Michigan history, the Palm Sunday tornado outbreak. It happened with virtually no warning, April 11th, 1965. Killer tornadoes smashed through the Midwest over a 12-hour span, 271 killed and more than 3,400 people hurt. And Michigan was one of the hardest hit states with 53 deaths. Dan Cherry is a Lenawee County historian. He's written two books on these Palm Sunday tornadoes, Night of the Wind and 50 Years Later. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dan, what was that day like, April 11th, 1965?
The day was warmer than the day before, where it was only 54 degrees across lower Michigan. The day on April 11th, 1965 had actually swelled to 73 very humid degrees. Some people took advantage of the warm weather to catch up on household chores, to go to their lake cottages, while others were a little concerned that the increase in temperatures might foster some severe thunderstorms that day.
So then what happened, meteorologically speaking? What kind of storm front built up? Where did it come from and where did it hit?
A cold front came from across the Upper Plains states, and a warm front from the Gulf of Mexico area had actually collided over the Upper Midwest earlier that day and spawned tornadoes about 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon across the Upper Midwest. That front moved eastward into Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan, and throughout the day, the number of tornadoes continued to tick upwards.
And here in Michigan, what was the first sign that something wasn't right?
In the early afternoon, people began to notice the sky across lower Michigan took on an eerie tan peach color. And what that was the agricultural dirt in Iowa and Illinois and Indiana was being pulled up into the atmosphere by the tornadoes that were already on the ground. That dirt and dust was being filtered throughout the air across lower Michigan as the color of dirt.
So when did Michigan get hit with the first tornado?
The first tornadoes began to touch down in the early evening hours as it was starting to get dark. There were several tornadoes that touched down along the Indiana-Michigan-Ohio line, and then there were others up near the Grand Rapids area, and those tornadoes began their march eastward under the cover of dusk and darkness.
How much warning did people have, Dan?
Unfortunately, the Weather Bureau, as it was known at the time, they didn't have all the tools that the National Weather Service has today to properly predict and get those warnings out to the people. Most people didn't know something was happening until they heard that rumbling freight train roar that many people associate with tornadoes. And some didn't hear that because they were in the direct path and didn't know what was going on until their houses actually started to come apart around them.
Wow. And then just as people were coming out of smashed buildings or basements or shelters, a second tornado?
Yes. Unfortunately, across lower Michigan, there was a second tornado on the same path as the first. People were in shock. They were completely taken off guard by the first tornado, and then all of a sudden here comes a second one in an unprecedented event.
What did the National Weather Service, as we now call it, it was the Weather Bureau in 1965, but what was learned and what happened because of this?
So much was learned from the 1965 tornado outbreak. Most of what we have in place today is a result of the 1965 tornado outbreak. They went with what they knew at the time, and unfortunately it takes tragedies like the 65 tornado outbreak for them to learn and to grow their resources and to become better prepared. Now we have real-time weather predictions. We would know a week in advance that this area would be susceptible to a tornado outbreak, and the area TV stations and radio stations would go live on the air as soon as those tornadoes started coming across Indiana, and they would stay on the air and alert people in real time what was going on, where they're going to strike, and what they needed to do to stay safe.
And now we have the wireless emergency alert, so it can hop right on your smartphone as well.
Yes. Here in Lenawee County, we do have a website where people can go and actually sign up for those weather alerts. And I understand that there are similar programs available in other municipalities and counties.
Well, it is something to realize that day, that Palm Sunday in 1965 on April 11th, still evokes pain 50 years later.
Yes, there are some neighbors and friends of mine who did experience the tornado that even today they say, I'm sorry, I just can't talk about it. It's too painful.
You can find out more about Dan Cherry's books on the Palm Sunday tornadoes, especially his latest book, 50 Years Later, by going to the Lenawee County Historical Museum website. It's lenaweemuseum.org. That's lenaweemuseum.org. Dan Cherry, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Believe it or not, April is Michigan Wine Month.
As we all look out on the gray, drizzly, muddy landscape, it would be nice if we had a greener month.
Well, coming up in 10 minutes, the next idea. We'll hear about ways to improve the Michigan wine industry's reputation and why that's important for everyone. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Looking for answers. That's what a group of parents and supporters are trying to do as they visit 43 American cities, hoping to shed light on the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico. It's called Caravana 43, and the group's in Lansing today. The college students vanished last September in Mexico. The Mexican government claims the 43 were taken and murdered by gang members. But family members and human rights groups are questioning those claims, and they're hoping the U.S. tour will pressure the Mexican government to tell the truth about what happened to those students. Sheila Contreras is with us now. She's director of Chicano Latino Studies at Michigan State University. Welcome to the program, Sheila.
Thank you.
Recap for us, would you, what happened to those students last September 26th?
Well, the students were on a bus. They were going to a social protest. They were heading to another city, and they were stopped by police, and they were questioned, they were detained, and they were fired upon. After they were detained by police, the understanding is that they were then handed over to forces outside the police. People say, you know, a drug cartel, at any rate, suggesting some kind of collusion between the police and forces outside the police, even those that, you know, ostensibly the police are trying to repress, the drug cartel.
Yes.
After that, it's unclear, as you said. It's unclear. The government is telling the families that the students are presumed dead and that they were all burned in a mass grave. But the families do not believe this, and they are asking for a continued investigation. So it is not really known what happened to the students. Three have been confirmed dead, but there are many more that are unaccounted for. And what we were told today by one of the mothers was that they have been presented with bodies, with remains of bodies, but that they know these are not their children.
Were there surviving students that you say there was cell phone video? So are there students who did get out and were able to say this is what happened?
What they're saying is, you know, some students hid, some students were able to get away. But what they're saying was that initially it was the police that began firing on them. And the video that is available online seems to confirm that. What people are saying is there was a collusion between police forces and I guess what everybody's saying is the drug cartels.
Sheila, do the parents of these 43 believe the students are still alive, or do they believe that they are dead but they're not being told the truth?
They believe their students, their sons, they believe they are alive. And what they are saying is they left us alive and we want them alive. Mm-hmm. That is their belief. They do not accept that their sons are dead, and they are asking for everybody's help to convince the Mexican government to continue its investigation and to find their children. One of the facts that we were told repeatedly is that some of the students' cell phones are still active. Cruz Bautista, who is here, his nephew, one of the disappeared students, he says his nephew's cell phone is active. And today is his nephew's birthday. He's 20 years old today.
I cannot even imagine what these family members have to be going through and to have to bring this story to the United States and visit these 43 cities and really keep these wounds fresh, but it keeps the story out there, right?
Exactly. And Maria de Jesus, the mother of one of the students, you know, she says she is the voice of all the mothers. She is the voice of all the students. And she feels responsibility. It's incredibly painful, incredibly painful. But the support gives strength, and we draw strength from their strength and courage. She said one of the things she talked about was that they have been very negatively depicted in Mexico as, you know, they're out seeking some sort of financial gain for this because they're poor people, that they just want money, you know, for mm-hmm. compensation. But she says, no, our children, we would not sell our children for all the gold in the world. The money is not for, you know, to make us be quiet or to make our lives better. The money is for el movimiento, the movement, and the money is to find our children. We would never sell our children.
Sheila, we're having, as you know, we all know that we're having conversations about impunity and in police force here in our own country. Do you think there are lessons that we can learn from what's happening in Mexico that we can draw on as we move forward in our nation with this, dealing with this growing lack of trust in some communities toward the police?
Well, I think one of the things we are seeing is that perhaps we are not as different as I think we are from so-called developing countries or the so-called third world, that we share struggles, we share common struggles. What we can learn from what we're seeing in Mexico, we can learn from the strength of civil society. We see a civil society that is more unified in Mexico, where you have union groups, citizen groups, not NGOs, nonprofits, all banding together to deliver a shared message. I think we can learn from that. We can learn how to organize across differences, across all kinds of lines and divisions, and unite around our shared interests and our shared desire for something better for all of us.
Sheila Contreras is Director of Chicano Latino Studies at Michigan State University. Sheila, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
The next idea is our vehicle for exploring a variety of ways to move Michigan forward. And certainly, that includes ideas for promoting and improving Michigan products. Our latest contributors to the next idea serve up some ideas for improving the reputation of Michigan's wine industry. Bill and Susan Bramer are owners of Laurentide Winery. It's midway between Leland and Sutton's Bay, right there on the Leelanau Peninsula. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
You both met while you were students at the University of Michigan. You were saying to me you are maize and blue in your heart, but you spent a lot of your careers prior to winemaking in California. Bill, what was your impression of Michigan wines while you were out amidst the vineyards of Napa Valley and Sonoma?
Well, it wasn't very good, honestly. Some of the wines that I had tried when I was younger, things of the ilk of soda pop wine, and generally Concord-based, and it really wasn't even clear to someone from the state, like myself, that high-quality fine wine could be produced from Michigan.
So what turned that around? Susan, what drew you to Leelanau and made you say, yep, we're going to plant a vineyard and we are going to start a winery in Michigan?
So what really turned it around was we tried the wines, and that made all the difference because there's a reputation you hear about, but then you have to check your facts. And by the time we had tried the wines, which was, I guess, about 15 years ago now, turned out to be very, very surprising. We both kind of looked at each other and said, wow, these are wonderful wines, very pure, high quality, sort of European in character.
And it made you say, all right, we're going to do it in Michigan. And here you are now really wanting to champion the reputation and the image of Michigan wines. And, you know, Bill, I don't need to tell you, the wine business is mighty competitive and reputations die hard. How do you describe the prevailing reputation in the wine world when someone says Michigan wine?
Well, that's a good question. And what I've seen, and it comes across in a couple ways, is when we give someone one of our wines, specifically our Sauvignon Blanc, which is very unique on the Michigan peninsulas, they will say, wow, this is the best Michigan wine I've ever had. And you see there's this bias already in their mindset because they say, this is a Michigan wine. So it has to be separated from, for example, French wine, Italian wine, California wine. And I think that bias is hard to overcome, and it happens not only with knowledgeable people, but also novices. I've actually had people look at our packaging and say, well, this wine doesn't look like a Michigan wine, nor does it taste like a Michigan wine.
Damned with faint praise, I think. Right? Kind of. I mean, it's almost a little bit of it's a compliment, but there's kind of a put down of Michigan.
Right, a little backhanded.
Yeah.
And it is, I don't think it's exclusive to Michigan wines. I think it's a general thing that happens with people's biases. People are biased in a number of areas, and it all has to do with preconceived notions about what you're expecting.
So people who think, hey, Michigan builds cars, doesn't make great wines.
Or they've heard that the best wine in the world comes from California, or they've heard that the best wine in the world can only be made in France. And then they go with that preconceived notion, and when they find their senses telling them something different, they actually have to do a double take. Hmm. It was kind of like when you're asking Susan, what made the difference? We tasted the wines. But even after having that experience, we had to go back and think about the final commitment because we had our own biases.
We're talking with Bill and Susan Bramer, who are the owners of Laurentide Winery. It's on the Leelanau Peninsula. And in your essay for the next idea, you admit it is hard to change a wine region's reputation. And you offer a few ideas for starting to change things in Michigan. And first, the fact we're celebrating Michigan Wine Month this month. And you think we could do better than the month of April?
April is a tough month. We're happy we have a Michigan Wine Month. Please do not mistake me. But as we all look out on the gray, drizzly, muddy landscape, it would be nice if we had a greener month to celebrate a wonderful, bountiful harvest. However, it's really more of the how we treat the month, how we actually embrace Michigan Wine Month. We do have events that are taking place throughout the state. However, even more needs to be done to popularize the month. I think if you talk to anyone on the street and you said, did you know that April is Michigan Wine Month? I would say 99% of the people would say, no, I really didn't, nor do they know that there actually is a Michigan Wine Month. So at this point, it's how do we embrace that and make it actually more popular, regardless of what type of time of year it is. I think Bill also had a comment on that too.
Well, we just opened a letter, and we've been invited to the 5th annual All Michigan Wine Tasting at a restaurant in Grand Rapids. So this is an example of, and it is dated, you know, in recognition of Michigan Wines Month. The event is actually going to be held in May so that they can use their outside terrace. But this is an example of the type of things that we can do as Michiganders, as restaurateurs, to embrace Michigan wines.
And you talk in your essay about the point of the fact that the local food movement, which so many restaurants have tapped into, really does need to extend to local wines. Do you have other ideas for getting Michigan restaurants to just, come on, serve more Michigan wines?
Well, one of the ways is that they have to become more familiar with the wines. So it is a give and take. Mm-hmm. We need to have them come up north or west, see the wineries that are in existence now, and have much more of an interplay between the people that make the wine and the people that buy and serve the wine. So one of the things that we'd really like to see happen is more communication between maybe just the restaurant associations, how we can make more of links between the vintners, the trails, the actual wineries, the winemakers, and the restaurateurs.
You also argue in your essay, in order to change the reputation of Michigan wines, we all kind of need to pitch in and help out. And you're hoping to see folks who perhaps don't have the highest or greatest opinion of Michigan wines to try them again. So make the case, Bill. How do you get someone to open up their mind to Michigan wines?
My personal belief is that they have to do it blinded. By that, I mean we can't put a Napa Valley Chardonnay in one side of the table and a Michigan Chardonnay on the other and say, try these two wines and tell me why you like or dislike which one. They have to not know what they're drinking. It's fine to let them know that this is a test and that we're going to be having more expensive wines against lesser expensive wines, but not let them let their biases interfere with their senses.
Could be a fun brown bag party.
It's a lot of fun. Susan and I, when we were in California, we were in the Livermore Valley, and we used to lead the wine club in our organization there, and we would have many blind tastings, and it was always interesting to see what people's opinions were. Oftentimes, we would be doing California against France, and now here we have a very similar bias that would be encountered here, like, for example, Michigan against California. Now the shoe's on the other foot. I still remember a Frenchman's face when we compared a lovely first growth Margaux with a Zinfandel from 1976. And of course, it was brown bag, and he had no idea, and he actually preferred the 1976 Zinfandel. A similar scenario could be envisioned where you see someone preferring a crisp Michigan Riesling to a Central Valley Riesling or a North Coast Riesling. And I'm not trying to be negative here. Mm-hmm. California makes wonderful wine. What we're trying to get people to recognize is that Michigan also makes wonderful wine.
If you're looking out into the future, let's say 10 years, Bill, when you imagine Michigan's wine industry in 10 years, what do you see?
Well, I still see continued growth. We were looking at some numbers recently with respect to what's occurred over the last 10 years. So the first time that we explored Leelanau Peninsula and really tasted those wines and took stock of what was there, I think we were looking at roughly 12 to 15 total wineries on Old Mission Peninsula and Leelanau. And now that number is close to 50. So 10 years from now, I wouldn't be surprised to see that number again significantly increase. And I see continued award. I mean, we've been winning significant awards, and I don't just speak for Leelanau here. I speak for the entire Michigan wine economy. Many great awards have been won over the last decade, and I would say that number will not only increase, but I think it'll be accelerated over the next 10 years, given the quality of the product and the experience of making fine wines that's being gained by the vintners. It really is something that takes practice, and you need multiple vintages to hone in on the best possible solutions. And every year is different. So that experience factor is building up, and we have winemakers with 20 great years of experience now. And, of course, new ones coming from all over the world every season. So with that collection and diversity, we can only improve.
And with that, we're going to refer everybody to their essay at the Next Idea page. You can just go to michiganradio.org and click on the Next Idea and read their essay. Bill and Susan Bramer, who are owners of the Laurentide Winery on the Leelanau Peninsula, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, billionaire developer and U of M super donor Stephen Ross on Detroit and the firing of U of M's athletic director. Then in 10 minutes, the past, the present, and future of high-speed internet service in Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You've got a long way to go. Straight-talking, no-nonsense words about Detroit from Stephen Ross, native Detroiter, University of Michigan benefactor, and one of the nation's most influential developers. He was talking about Detroit's transformation in a rare interview with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. So, Daniel, you get a rare chance to talk with Stephen Ross. He doesn't do many interviews. What kind of guy is this man who's worth $6.5 billion?
It's easy to talk to, I think. He's got a real fluency with issues around here. He is the nephew of the late Max Fisher, a very famous philanthropist here in Metro Detroit. So he knows the area, went to Wayne State Law School, went to Michigan undergrad, and as you pointed out, he's, I think, if not the largest, one of the largest donors in Michigan history, having donated over $300 million to the university.
So he took a driving tour of his hometown. How does Stephen Ross see post-bankruptcy Detroit?
Well, I think he sees it with a kind of a cold eye, and I think that kind of comes through in the piece. I mean, he says, look, there's some things that are going well. He says, God bless Danny Gilbert, as he calls Dan Gilbert, for what he's doing, but he can't do it alone, and he can't do it just in downtown. And he's really focusing on kind of the realistic issues that I think other people are when you talk to them about it. You've got to create incentives for people to want to move into the city. It's got to be more than just downtown. You've got to be able to have jobs. And he and I talked a little bit about that, about the difficulty of employing certain kinds of people in Detroit and who is coming into work in Detroit. And I think he sees this as a long-term challenge. His company is doing some of the largest developments in the United States, one of which in New York right now may be the largest development ever undertaken in the history of the country. When I asked him, and he loves transformative projects, and when I said, what's more transformative than Detroit?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, actually, we are beginning to look at potentially doing something there, but I don't think it would be anything on the grand scale. I mean, if you look at the portfolio of companies and the investments that they do very high-end developments in places where there's a lot of people with, frankly, a lot of money.
Which is not the case yet. And it almost, as he talked to you about needing to make Detroit a live, work, and play place, that in order to do that, you need more private sector jobs and better services in the city's delivery. It's almost like a chicken and egg thing, isn't it?
Well, it really is. And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, you see with the efforts of Gilbert and Bedrock and what they're doing, they are trying to create a live, work, and play environment in downtown. But it's a much longer thing. He uses the word deliverables. I'm not even sure if that's a real English word, but he says that they basically, you have to have deliverables, and what he means by that is the kind of city services that people feel safe, that the garbage gets picked up, that, you know, the basics are provided by the city, and as we know, they've just gone through bankruptcy, and they're really now starting to make some traction on that, for example, with streetlights and things like that. So there's a long way to go, and I don't think that he would sit there and say, you know, Detroit is there. He's not rah-rah about the whole thing, which I think is kind of encouraging, frankly.
Yeah, he's, as you write in your piece today, he sees flashes of revival downtown and in Midtown. So there are, I guess, encouraging signs, but don't ever think we're there yet.
No, and I think anybody who really knows these issues, yeah, from Mayor Duggan to Dan Gilbert to people who work for him, everybody knows that. That's not a secret. The problem is, in this state, we tend to approach this issue in a kind of a bipolar way. And what I mean by that is you're either rah, 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 or you take the other attitude, which is nothing's ever going to change in Detroit, ever.
Yeah.
And I don't think either one of those are correct. And I think people need to be more realistic and understand that this is not a destination, but it's a process. And as a word he used, and it's a word I've used a lot in trying to talk about these kinds of things, that what's happening in Detroit is a process. And is the process moving forward or is it moving backward? And I think in the last couple of years, we would say that it's basically moving forward, and we got to keep moving in that direction.
You also talked with Stephen Ross about sports at the University of Michigan, where, as you noted, he has donated more than $300 million. And also in pro sports, of course, we know he's owner of the Miami Dolphins, which makes him Ndamukong Suh's new boss. Start out with what he wants to do to end bullying and racism in pro sports.
Well, about the time he was doing the driving tour in Detroit, news broke of a bullying incident on the Miami Dolphins, where a guard by the name of Richie Incognito was sending racially tinged text messages to a teammate, Jonathan Martin, who was also an offensive lineman but younger than Incognito. And it raised this whole issue of racism in sports and bullying, and I think Stephen Ross, as the owner, saw that this could put a permanent stain on his franchise. And there are financial implications for that. There are societal implications for that. And he had just been in Detroit, and he says, you know, and driving around and seeing what had happened to the city that at one time he very much identified with, and he has family living in and around, he saw kind of a parallel there, the insidiousness of racism. And so what he's doing, and this is the first time he's talked about it publicly, is he's formed a nonprofit, and it's called RISE, the Ross Institute for Sports Equality. And it's going to be working with all the major sports leagues, and they expect to be naming an executive director sometime in the next month or two, and it would be based in New York.
And he says he told you he really wants to have this reach down to right when kids first start playing ball.
Right. He's all about role models, and I know there are certain professional athletes that don't like being told or expected to be role models for younger people, but I think some of us, or a lot of us, probably believe that they are, and their behavior can be modeled, and I think that's one of the things he's hoping to do.
As for Michigan's troubled sports program, Stephen Ross told you his $300 million in donations couldn't save Dave Brandon from being fired as athletic director.
No, in fact, he to something to be effective, to show you how much they listen to me, I wanted Dave to stay. No, I think it's very interesting. What is really interesting about this whole thing, as you put it together over time, is you find out that a lot of the major players never knew each other. You know, Jim Hackett hadn't met the president until the president asked him to take on this job as interim athletic director. Stephen Ross said he'd never met Jim Hackett until the president decided that that's who he was going to pick.
And that's President Mark Schlissel. Yeah,
that's right. And so they put all this together. But I think the arc of how this whole thing played out is somewhat surprising. There were a lot of assumptions that Stephen Ross, particularly because of his NFL ownership and being a major donor, played a huge role in this and what happened, and it appears that he really didn't. Now, at one time when Jim Harbaugh was going to the San Francisco 49ers about 4 years ago, Mr. Ross was very interested in trying to get him to Miami. But when Michigan was looking for another coach here just a few months ago, he was not involved in that, or so he says.
So the finger wasn't in the pie perhaps as much as some thought.
Yeah, and he ultimately decided to keep his coach in Miami, so it kind of became a non-issue.
Interesting stuff, all kinds of things, centered on Daniel Howe's conversation with Stephen Ross. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
yesterday's Stateside, we met the co-founders of Rocket Fiber, the ultra-high-speed internet service coming to downtown Detroit later this year and next year to midtown Detroit. The prospect of fiber optic cable serving up internet at least 100 times faster than what most of us are used to is mighty appealing. What is the history and the future of gigabit speed internet in Detroit and in Michigan? Larry Gant is here now with us. He's a professor at both the School of Social Work and the Penny W. Stamps School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Rocket Fiber's Mark Foster told us he wanted to beat Google to the punch and get that fiber optic internet into Detroit. But this isn't the first crack at this in Southeast Michigan, is it?
No, it's not. There have been at least two prior attempts to do something with the fiber system, the fiber cables in Detroit, particularly in downtown, midtown Detroit. There are a couple of examples of that. Gigatrans, certainly in the early 2000s. And then that was followed up by another attempt by Wayne State University and a corporation called Clearwire in about 2005, 2007.
Now, what happened to the two earlier attempts with Gigatrans and Clearwire?
Unlike the current activity, the expectations for both Gigatrans and for Clearwire, the thought was basically charge the corporations a large sum of money and then use that to subsidize high-speed Wi-Fi to the surrounding neighborhoods at a more reasonable price point, around $18 a month.
Sounds like a great idea. What happened?
Well, Gigatrans, I think the business model really suffered. The thought was they needed to have a certain core of businesses, you know, utilizing Gigatrans. And I think that that did not materialize. I'm not quite sure what the model was and what the price point was for the corporations, but it was never sufficient enough. The price point was reasonable for families at $18 a month, but that there weren't enough families signing up. Gigatrans, the heart and soul was actually James Rose. And when he died, the family basically decided to liquidate the holdings of Gigatrans.
Okay.
And so it was sold off bit by bit. I think with Clearwire, that was something a little bit different, Cynthia. Clearwire was a company. They had a partnership with Wayne State University. They were also a part of the One Economy movement, an organization which worked out of Ohio. And Clearwire put all of its money down, you know, kind of bet the farm, if you will, on a technology which is called WiMAX. WiMAX was a kind of a forerunner of, you know, 4LTE and other kinds of Wi-Fi solutions. WiMAX was seen as the next big thing. There were unfortunately some technology limitations to WiMAX. The most notable one was that while WiMAX was very fast, and the signal couldn't penetrate houses, couldn't penetrate walls, couldn't penetrate. So there was this notion of creating lots and lots of antennas to kind of saturate neighborhoods. That was a technological challenge, and I think when Sprint and when other companies came up with other technologies that provided solutions to WiMAX, Clearwire basically said, okay, this is a technology competition piece. We lost this.
Yeah.
We're
going to fold our tent.
Yeah, we'll fold the tent. And, you know, the other larger telecoms went the other way. So the thought, I think, was, well, there are two possibilities here, WiMAX and then 3LTE, 4LTE, and the LTEs provided the solutions that WiMAX didn't.
We were told by Mark and Eddie from Rocket Fiber, if they get all that 1 gigabit speed internet service downtown, they want to expand into certainly midtown, other areas as well, Corktown and Woodbridge and Eastern Market and Lafayette Park and Rivertown. What's your thought? Do you see this becoming a profitable, self-sustaining effort?
It's really hard to say. I don't know what the business model is. I don't know what the price points are.
The demand is probably growing as people are coming downtown to move and in the outlying areas, no?
Well, if they've got the ability to pay, and certainly the neighborhoods that you mentioned that they indicated, those are the neighborhoods that are undergoing substantial gentrification. And people are moving into those relatively small areas that are very, very closely packed right around to the downtown and to the midtown areas.
Yeah.
So it certainly seems on the one hand that there might be market share sufficient to make this a sustainable initiative. I don't know, though.
Yeah. You know, the idea that Comcast is going to be pulling out of Michigan when it merges with Time Warner, I'm wondering, what do you see when that happens and Greatland Connections takes over? Do you think they're capitalized enough to keep internet service at least at current levels, if not actually improving?
That was, I think, the other big reason that GigaTrans had concern, as well as the Clearwire initiative. So it wasn't all only the problematic technology for Clearwire. It was also Comcast saying, you know what, we will undercut any kind of expectation there.
We will crush you.
And they essentially provided a real compelling price point themselves.
Sure.
They talked about cable as opposed to signals being placed by antennas. Mm-hmm. Now Comcast is going to be migrating on. My own opinion is the people that are replacing Comcast are going to probably end up being purchased by another entity that wants to basically make a lot of money liquidating assets. At some point, it wouldn't surprise me if the new entity ended up selling to Dan Gilbert, to this new business that's coming up.
Because those of us that have Comcast just want to know, are we going to be able to watch Game of Thrones the way we're used to?
I don't know. You may have another provider, but I don't think it's going to be that current provider that's currently taking over where Comcast is going.
We're talking with Larry Gant, who's a professor at the School of Social Work and the Penny W. Stamm School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan, as we look at ultra-high-speed internet service coming to downtown Detroit. We had talked with the co-owners of Rocket Fiber, so that is one option. And it seems that Detroit is getting closer and closer, Larry, to looking like a real tech incubator, especially if Rocket Fiber succeeds in what it wants to do and to close a digital gap. But what are you watching for reaching out to the neighborhoods? And they do say that's part of their mission. They want to train. They want to have a brick-and-mortar store where people can come for training. And they do want to close that digital divide. What do you see happening there?
There are some technological problems that I'm not that equipped to speak on that they're going to have to address. I mean, the majority of fiber is in downtown. If you want to go out to the other neighborhoods, or you're going to have to punch that out with some kind of signal transmission. You can't extend the cable. You can only extend that so far. The other is they might talk about allocating and distributing tiers of high-speed service. Mm-hmm. So it won't be gigabit speed. It'll be something that's slower, but something that still may get the job done. Now you kind of run into the issues of what's being talked about in terms of net neutrality, where, you know, people are really concerned on the one hand of providers, you know, basically being able to offer slower access to poorer neighborhoods and poorer communities. You got a situation here perhaps where the business plan of the initiative might also say, well, you know what, if you can afford it really, really high speed, and if you can't afford it, it'll be slower, but it won't be so bad.
What about other underserved areas, rural areas, for example? What is on the horizon, do you think, for improving internet speed and access?
You're still talking about some sort of satellite. You're still talking about a signal. Yeah. And it's really, really unlikely that there'll be any more fiber being laid. As a matter of fact, the reason that this current group is actually using the fiber is because it's been there. Mm. It's there.
It's there.
It's there. It doesn't have to be laid out. Mm. It's simply there not being utilized. That is not the case for these rural communities.
I actually saw Google has something called Project Loon, a balloon network for rural and remote areas or to fill in those coverage spots. And then Facebook's talking about using a drone to beam down internet service with laser. So minds are working.
Minds are working. Several years ago, around 2009, 2010 in China, the Chinese government and some of the Chinese run businesses were experimenting with the same technology. Mm-hmm. You know, around having, you know, mobile platforms for beaming in information and beaming high-speed internet access to a lot of rural communities. So that's not a new idea. Maybe new to the U.S., but it's not new globally.
Was it successful?
Pilot runs indicated some degree of success, but I think that there were also some technological challenges. But conceptually, it appears to work.
Interesting. Larry Gant, professor at both the School of Social Work and the Penny W. Stamm School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan. Larry, thank you so much.
Pleasure as always. Thanks a lot.
We always want to hear from you. What stories are you thinking about and issues do you want to hear more about? Just let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstroth, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.